News Centre at 5. A man will spend at least 20 years in prison for murdering his brother and trying to kill his brother's girlfriend by setting them on fire. 27-year-old Blair Logan admitted pouring petrol on the pair as they slept in a house near Glasgow on New Year's Day, but said he'd not intended to kill them. Four high-rise towers in South London could be evacuated because of structural problems. Tim Jones reports.
Vaughan de Hill lives in a block which could collapse if there's an explosion.
How do I feel? Angry.
Experts reckon the towers may not be stable enough. Here's architect Peter Murray.
These issues have been known in the trade for many years.
Southwark Council's deputy leader says they've taken action.
The right option is to actually eliminate that risk and actually turn the gas supply off.
Residents on the Ledbury estate say cracks in the walls have been ignored for years. Here's local MP Harriet Harman.
It's going to cost money to sort out all the structural problems.
She wants the government to fund the work.
11 members of a family gang have been convicted of modern slavery and fraud offences. Based on traveller sites in Lincolnshire, the members of the Rooney family forced a succession of vulnerable people to work for little or no pay. In contrast, they took holidays in Barbados. Our reporter Louisa Pilbeam has more details.
They targeted vulnerable people, people living on the streets who were perhaps addicted to alcohol and drugs. So they plied these people with things that they knew would keep them in their control.
The Egyptian Health Ministry says 36 people have been killed after two trains collided in the coastal city of Alexandria. More than 120 are injured. Reality TV star Jeremy McConnell has got to do 200 hours of community service for assaulting his ex-girlfriend, former Hollyoaks star Stephanie Davis, back in March. And a union is warning that a long-running dispute that's left rubbish piling up in Birmingham could continue until Christmas. The City Council has promised to clear the black bags by today. Refuse workers have been on strike since June in a row over job losses. That's the latest. I'm Andy Hayes.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping us review this week's news. It's Labour councillor for Brislington West, Harriet Bradley. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, North Korea's threatening the US island of Guam in the Pacific, so never mind the Pentagon. What do the 100,000 or so native Chamorros people think? And how real is the North Korean threat? Also, a government leak this week reveals Private Healthcare Secretary Jeremy Hunt has secretly doubled the number of NHS properties up for sale, just as the NADA report suggested. And is Jacob Rothschild's pal Oliver Letwin's plan to destroy the NHS before the next general election well underway in secret? Plus, how well does a culture of denial and cover-up sit around the United Bristol Hospital's NHS Trust executive and board? Local man Alan Condon's baby son Benjamin was admitted to Bristol Children's Hospital with a suspected cold, but caught a superbug there. It took the trust 18 months and legal threats before they admitted they'd misled Alan and the rest of the family on several counts, and that tiny Benjamin had been given a drug which he shouldn't have been. We invited former Master of the Merchant Venturers and so-called independent chairman of the Trust, who has responsibility for ethics, John Savage, as well as any other trustees or members of the Executive Board on this show, but were told by Abby Evans in the UHB headquarters at the end of Jamaica Street that none of the 25 or so running the Trust was available today. So what happens when you're paying their wages but you can't trust the Trust? Plus another look at 9/11 from another scholar. This week it's the turn of Jim Mars, author of Rule by Secrecy, amongst many other books, who sadly died this week in Fort Worth, Texas. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 degrees Celsius and some drizzle. This weekend, highs of 21, mainly cloudy with occasional outbreaks of sun So a little bit of sun this weekend. Next week, highs of 21, plenty of showers, but also some sunny spells. So showers and sun as well. It's been like that for weeks and weeks now, isn't it? Next weekend, that's the 19th and 20th of August, highs of 18 Celsius, heavy showers and some sunshine. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Brislington West, Harriet Bradley. Hi, Harriet. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, very pleased to be here.
And tell us a bit about your background. You only became a councillor for the first time, I understand, last May. So you've been doing it for just over a year.
That's right. I'm still a newbie. I'm actually an academic by trade, and I still work at UWE.
So, and what subject?
Sociology is my subject. I did English a long time ago at Bristol University, so I'm very attached to Bristol. I've worked at Bristol University, and now I'm at UWE, which I really like. And I'm doing research at the moment into graduate employability, following students from Bristol and from UWE into the labour market, which has been a fascinating bit of research. So I decided to become a councillor, I think, because I felt that after the 2015 election, the Labour Party had a bit lost its way, and I wanted to help steer it back into what I thought was the right path.
Are you talking about Jeremy Corbyn?
I am. I have to say, I've seen Jeremy today. He's been in Bristol, as you probably know. We're greeted by an enthusiastic crowd. It's a bit of a shame that it was only Labour Party members, so ordinary Bristolians didn't get the chance to listen to him, but it was a good
But you're
meeting.
Not a fan of Jeremy Corbyn, really?
Yes, I am.
Oh, you are?
Definitely.
So when
yes.
you said, I thought you said that, that the Labour Party had lost its way under him.
Ah, but that was before Corbyn stood as leader, remember? That's when you stand for a councillor a year before you actually get elected. So when I joined the Labour Party, it was the leadership election, the first one, which Corbyn eventually won.
Well, it hasn't really helped the Labour Party, has it, effectively having two leadership elections in 2 years? And some have even talked about some of the Labour MPs, some of the Labour Party members, as Blairites, effectively trying to sabotage Jeremy Corbyn's leadership bid.
It has been a very difficult time for the Labour Party, but I'm hoping and trusting that we've moved beyond that now. Part of the reason why people seemed hostile to Corbyn's leadership was that they thought he was unelectable. But the good result in the recent general election, which was much better than everybody thought it would be, has actually brought a lot of MPs to say we need to build bridges now. And I think that's a very strong feeling. And here in Bristol, we've always worked together as a party across our different political positions, because obviously we do some of us are more left like myself, and some of us are more right.
Let's go back to what you were saying about your job as an academic. What is sociology?
Sociology is the study of society, which is a bit vague, but it means actually looking at social institutions such as the family, factories, the workplace, schools, all the media. Everything that makes up Britain today and the other countries today, we study how these things work.
And how they don't work, I suppose.
And how they go wrong, yes, absolutely.
So what's your sociological analysis of Bristol today, then?
Well, Bristol is an amazing place, which I absolutely love. I'm really committed to Bristol. As you know, it's a very diverse and multicultural city. And like all cities like that, I was in Leicester for a time, which is also very multicultural, and there are problems. You know, Leicester had some riots, we had the St Paul's riots here, but I think we've come through all that now, and I get a feeling, particularly among the younger generation, that there is a real appreciation of diversity and a desire to make it work, which is great.
To some people it's diversity, to others it's being swamped by foreigners.
Yes, I think that is still true of some of the older people in our community, the kind of people who voted for Brexit. And we know that older working class people have felt threatened by immigration, although immigration is actually rather controlled despite appearances.
Well, it's not controlled. It's over 300,000 people a year coming into the UK now, whereas before Maastricht it was something like 10,000 a year.
Yes, obviously the change is that people from Europe can come in uncontrolled. They can't from other parts of the world, of course. And I suppose it's European immigration that has started to worry people. We do, of course, have a lot of Polish people in Bristol, as I'm sure you know. And in fact, there are quite a lot of Polish people living in Brislington Ward. But certainly in Brislington, I don't think there's any ill feeling against migrants. And when people have those negative feelings, it's often because they don't understand how the migrants fit into society, because often they take on jobs that other people won't do. For example, you may have read in the papers recently about fruit rotting in the fields of East Anglia because Eastern Europeans have been brought in to do the harvest, and British people, for some reason, don't want to do that. It is backbreaking.
Well, I'll tell you
work.
What the reason is, probably because they're not being paid enough.
They don't get paid enough. No,
so, but I mean, you know, you must surely admit that having every 3 years an extra million people in Britain does have an effect, which is not, you don't have to be a racist to say, hang on, is this really working? Because, of course, yes. It undermines what the unions have been doing for decades.
I trying totally
to get,
agree with that,
you
yes.
know, keep pay and conditions up. Yes. This is undermining it.
It is a problem because employers will bring in people and pay them less than decent wages, and also house them in terrible conditions. So there is a worry there. And I think Jeremy Corbyn at the moment is trying to find a balance to think about how we handle that by bringing in much stricter labour controls about pay, regulation, workers' rights, which would stop those abuses. So, and also, you know, hopefully finding ways to regenerate some bits of our economy so that white working class people and young black people who are perhaps the victims at the moment of the system do find jobs.
Well, one of the problems is bound to be housing costs and housing. Many of the councillors we have on here say that it's one of the commonest things that they're called about is potential eviction, not being able to pay the yes. rent, problems with housing benefit. Myself recently, I had some problems with the housing benefit and was told, well, it's taking anything up to 3 months to even deal with claims.
Yes, there's a massive waiting list. It is an absolutely disastrous situation. We're all very worried about it. Across all the parties, we know that Bristol has a housing crisis. I actually sit on the planning committee, and it's incredibly frustrating because houses are being built, but the planners, the developers, don't want to build cheap housing. They want to build luxury little apartments, and I'm afraid a lot of those are bought by people who don't even live in Bristol as an investment. What's happened is that housing has become a source of wealth, a source of investment, instead of catering for the needs of working people. We've got to change that culture somehow, but it's very difficult to do because at the moment the legislation which was brought in by the Lib Dem Tory coalition absolutely ties us as councillors. We're always wanting to ask the developers to have the 30% target of affordable housing, including social housing, which Bristol City Council has set as its target. But they just tell us every time that it won't be profitable if they have that amount. So we're in a sort of catch-22, really.
Well, they're sticking two fingers up at you, really, aren't they?
They
saying,
are.
Well,
you're right.
We're not going to do it.
Yes, you'll know about the fuss about the chocolate factory. We turned it down.
This is Canesham Chocolate Factory, or
no,
is it? No, it's
this
the other
is
one.
The Elizabeth Shore, okay, the old yeah. Elizabeth Shore.
Yes, tell us about
yeah.
that.
Yes, well, the residents were up in arms about this. It's a very inclusive sort of community, and they were very keen on there being affordable housing. We were deluged with letters from the residents. I must have had about, because I'm on the planning committee, I must have had about 500 communications from concerned residents, all saying that they wanted to make sure there was a proper amount of affordable housing. So there was a lot of bargaining that went on behind the scenes, but they only came up, I think, with about 10 units out of a large number, which was nothing. So we on the planning committee voted to reject the proposal. And then, of course, what happened was that they put in an appeal, and the government inspector came along and said, OK, you know, they were wrong, the council was wrong, you can build it, and you don't have to provide any affordable housing. So we're back in negotiation now, trying to get a few affordable in, but this is the problem we face.
Well, first of all, you're at a planning committee. The developer can appeal, but the local people can't appeal, so it's very skewed. The yes, other thing is, it yes. seems to me, what you're saying is only money matters, people don't matter at all.
Well, I'm afraid that's what the developers tend to be like. But there are developers and developers. There's a company called Sovereign, which is taking over an old factory in Brislington West. And they're actually a housing association, although they are developers. And they have a much more helpful attitude. They do care about what the quality of the housing they produce and its affordability. They're, all developers will have to include some high cost housing to make a profit because of the soaring values of land. But yeah, it's a real conundrum. I don't know what the solution is.
Well, I mean, you look at somewhere like Bali, where I was February this year, and you see that the housing costs are very, very minimal. People yes. don't have marvellous houses, but they can build pretty much wherever they want, virtually for nothing. And, of course, as a result, they haven't got massive housing costs. And yes. they can kind of just get on and make stuff and do stuff.
What I'm always trying to advocate is these housing kits. Have you seen those? They have them in Scandinavia. You can just sort of, you bring them in a lorry and you stick them down. They're not very big, but they're perfectly serviceable.
And are you going to promise to give planning permission to people that come along with those?
Well, no, we can't just let people put down houses where they want. But I would like certainly to see developers encouraged to put some of those in,
Martin,
because they're cheap.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Let's look at this real knotty conundrum of housing, how much they cost to build and how much they cost to buy, how much it costs to rent a house. It's just a racket, effectively, isn't it? The market is absolutely sewn up, and we're in a situation now right here in Bristol where there are many properties that have got planning permission, but the developers aren't building them and they're not selling them because they're not selling the houses they have built. They're so expensive.
Well, I mean, you've got to actually change the fundamental way you look at this. It's got huge macroeconomic implications as well. Britain's housing problems and property bubbles. We're in the middle of another property bubble, probably the third or fourth in my lifetime, and they always end the same way with a crash, and this will end with a crash as well. And of course, in other European countries, they don't have these kind of property bubbles. In Germany, the average price of renting a house or buying a house has remained pretty much the same since the Second World War.
Also, of course, it's
and that's
much
normal.
Closer.
That's
it's
what
much
normal
closer
looks like
to the actual cost of building a house spread over a long period of time. At the moment, we've got over the last 3 or 4 months. I'm not sure which cities it has been affecting in Britain, but we've started to see a levelling out and even a dipping of the house prices, Martin. This could be a bit of a warning sign.
Well, what they're hoping is that it'll just go sideways for a bit and cool off, but I'm afraid property bubbles don't do that. They burst. And of course, people have got so used to the idea, you know, you go to university, you get a degree, you get a mortgage, and then that's free money from the government, because that's what it is. Capital gains like that is free money from society, and people use it as their pension, etc. And then of course they go into buy to let if they're able to, and so on. But of course that's not normal. In places like Stockholm, they built not just adequate, good quality housing, but, you know, the Prime Minister will be housed in exactly the same kind of apartment as the bin man who lived down the street, and that's the way they run it.
Now, Harriet Bradley's with us. She's the Labour councillor for Brislington West. Harriet, we've had a report from Crisis this week that nearly 160,000 households, estimated at just under 250,000 people, are experiencing the worst forms of homelessness across Britain, with rough sleeping forecast to rise by 76% in the next decade under the government in Westminster, Scotland and Wales' long-term action to tackle it. This is according to a new expert analysis conducted for Crisis by Heriot Watt University, providing the most complete picture to date of the worst forms of homelessness, including rough sleeping, sofa surfing, as well as 25-year forecasts for each category right across England, Wales and Scotland. But these are horrific figures.
absolutely terrible. And of course, young people are at the sharp end of this. A lot of young people are couch surfing because they simply can't afford the enormously expensive rents. I mean, I've got a stepdaughter who's living in London at the moment, which of course has got the highest rents in the country, though Bristol is pounding along fast behind. And actually Bristol is said to have the second highest rate of homelessness after London, I believe, so it's a real problem here. But she's had been paying £2,000 a month for what I think of as a horrible little pokey flat, frankly. And it's just impossible for people, particularly people who've just got their degrees, because they simply are not earning the kind of wages that can pay for that. So there's a major problem there. People on benefits are struggling to pay their rents. Evictions have been going up steadily. And as we said before, there's a lack of affordable housing, and certainly a lack of social housing in Bristol. So you've got a perfect storm, really, which is terrible.
One wonders whether Brexit will make a difference to this in a couple of years' time, if there are then restrictions on migrants, because there won't be this constant extra demand for housing. At that point, maybe it will start to fall, the housing levels will start to fall. But Martin, some of the figures in this report are pretty shocking. 9,100 people are sleeping rough, compared to previous estimates around 4,000. That's around about 2010, so that's more than doubled. 68,000 plus households are sofa surfing. Nearly 20,000 households living at unsuitable temporary accommodation. Of course, some of those are the Grenfell Tower people who still haven't been given any kind of permanent place to live months after, even though they were promised by the Prime Minister. Then there's nearly 40,000 households living in hostels, 25,000 or so living in other circumstances, including 9,000 households sleeping in tents, cars or on public transport. I don't know how you sleep on public transport. I suppose on a train or a tube train. Or a bus or something. Yeah. Then also 12,100 households squatting, 5,000 households in women's refuges or winter night shelters. Now, these are actually incredible figures, Martin.
They are, and of course these people don't count for much in our political system. They tend to be concentrated in inner city areas and under first past the post, even if they were to participate in elections, and frequently they don't, because if you're moving around you don't register, all it would do would be pile up support for Labour in areas in seats it was going to win anyway. And of course they don't count for anything. And, a change in the... I mean, in Northern Ireland, for example, you've still got the rating system in Northern Ireland. There are proportional elections to the assemblies and so on. Their housing crisis is much less severe than ours.
Just picking on the squatters, for example, doing a rough ballpark estimate, you know, you're talking there about round about 60 or 70 million pounds those people are saving from the housing benefit bill, the fact that they're squatting. Amazing, really, to think, you know, that money should be being paid to them for adequate housing, and actually the government's managing to save money at the same time restricting squatters' rights. Harriet,
well, they're throwing them out too, and shockingly, as you probably have read in certain cities, I'm glad to say, not yet in Bristol, in Sheffield, they're actually fining people for sleeping on the streets. I mean, how ridiculous is that? These poor people don't have any money anyway.
Martin,
to fine them.
What's
ridiculous.
The implication of criminalising homelessness?
Well, it's creating the idea that what's been going on since the crisis and the crash in 2008 is an attempt to make the poor look as if they are the guilty parties. So you still come across people in pubs who say, oh, well, the real problem is all these people who aren't working sleeping on the streets, and they're the ones who are cadging off the society. Whereas in actual fact, of course, the way the housing market works in this country, those who get on the housing ladder at whatever level are given free money by the society. And they just take it as normal and take it for granted. People bought their own council houses at less than market value. They've made massive capital gains on the back of that, and that's often changed their voting allegiance. But that's just a handout by the government to certain sections of the population. And of course, what we should be doing is seeing housing as a right rather than as something that people have to compete in the marketplace for. And of course that has macroeconomic implications. The Tory government of the 1950s built the most council housing in Britain. They were the ones that did the most. And of course what it did is it kept house prices down for people who were buying houses, and it also provided adequate housing for people who couldn't afford to buy houses. And let's face it, under a free market economy, at least a third of the population cannot afford decent accommodation. That's why it has to be subsidised. They understand this in Scandinavia. In Norway, for example, you've got a minister of housing, and that's all they do is housing.
Can I mention another problem which is addressing, we are trying to address, and that is the developers' rush into student housing. You must have noticed how in the centre of Bristol there's endless blocks of student housing going up, and almost every development, the big and controversial development in Bedminster Green, which is being opposed by the Residents Association, contains student housing. And even sort of little development sites have got student housing in. I wonder if students are actually living in these places. But it's like a carrot to the developers, because they don't have to pay any council tax on those buildings,
well,
or any taxes
well.
Or business tax.
They've got their rent paid guaranteed, because the students will get the student loan. So it's really the city giving money to the students.
Exactly.
They just know that these people are going to be able to pay their rents, because they're going into massive amounts of debt as part of their being students.
Absolutely. So it's a bit of a racket, really. And I do wonder if there are lots of empty rooms in these, because we have found out through talking to students that students actually prefer to live in houses like where I live in Redland. We got student houses on either side of us with about six students in, and they prefer that because it's more homely, you know, and more free. And I just wonder if there's loads of empty houses, empty rooms in these houses that could be filled by some of these unfortunate people who are forced to squat or sleep in doorways.
Well, a little bird tells me that a massive great building just around the back of the council house has just been sold by the city council as well for student housing.
Yes, it has. You're right. Yeah. There's already a lot of student housing in that street anyway.
On the other end of the scale, of course, we've got the royal family. And the royal family suffered a bit of a blow on Sunday on Channel 4, as Channel 4 got their highest ratings of the year so far. We did trail this a bit, plug it last Friday. And it wasn't surprising that more people watched this than any other programme on Channel 4 so far this year, because it was absolutely riveting insight into the relationship between Prince Charles and Diana, and also into the morals, I suppose, of the royal family. Shocking that Diana should go to the Queen and ask what she could do about Charles having a mistress, and the Queen kind of throwing her hands up and saying, oh well, Charles is just like that, you know, he's a difficult character, and offering her no real practical help or advice. So let's have a listen now to an extract from that, and I've got several extracts here, we start by having a look at the media attention that Diana was attracting. This is in the early 1990s, before there was really announcements of her actually having a divorce from Charles, and there was a lot of rumours going around about the relationship not going too well. But also in front of an audience, it's quite shocking to hear Prince Charles talking about having two wives while Diana is sort of stood there looking rather sheepish. An awful thing to do in front of her and in front of a big audience, where it was obviously very difficult for her to say, yes, I wish you didn't have two wives, Charles. So let's have a listen to that clip now.
With the media attention came a lot of jealousy.
I've come to the conclusion that really it would have been far easier to have had two wives. To have covered both sides of the street. And I could have walked down the middle directing the operation.
We were a very good team in public, albeit what was going on in private. Rampant bulimia, feeling of being no good at anything and failed in every direction. A husband who loved someone else. I knew it. You just know.
That's someone voicing the voice of Princess Diana there, because obviously the BBC wouldn't release the panorama film for Channel 4 to use as part of that. That was the fascinating documentary that Diana did with Panorama on the BBC before she died. We're supposed to believe that the royal family, Harriet, are sort of there to attract the tourists, but of course they've got loads of palaces, they've got loads of money, and people are starting to ask questions about whether they're really up to the job.
I think there is a lot of concern about the enormous amounts of money we pay them. By the way, I didn't see that programme, but I found that excerpt you just played incredibly moving. Really sad and rather horrific that Charles could joke about having two wives. It really rather an abominable piece of patriarchal thinking, frankly. But to go back to the royal family, I mean, I think people still really love the Queen. And they do seem to have taken to Will and Kate. There's another attractive young woman and a family that seems to be doing all right. So I don't know. I think there's always been a strong anti-royalist streak in Britain. I was actually brought up as an anti-royalist by a fierce mother who wouldn't sit, who wouldn't stand up for the national anthem in cinemas. You know, well, it's going back a long time, but they always used to play it at the end of the show. And I was incredibly embarrassed because there was I sort of standing up and my mum was sitting down. But there are, on the other hand, there are loads of people who really love the royal family, and it has a kind of soapish appeal, doesn't it? You know, even when it gets into trouble, as with the tragic tale of Princess Diana, people follow the stories and the ins and out, the marriages, the weddings. This all attracts publicity. They are superstars in a way.
There was quite a lot of people in our parents' generation, I think, that... we talked about the royal family as a bunch of posh gangsters.
Yes, well, that's quite a good way of putting some of them. They do, I suppose, work hard. I mean, Prince Harry has just said that he thinks that they should not have to do this job, doesn't he? He seems to be a bit of a anti-royalist himself. And it must be quite hard being forced to be polite and nice and go and shake people's hands and pat babies on the heads all the time. I wouldn't enjoy it.
Well, another angle to this was, which has made some headlines as well, was the death of the close friend and bodyguard of Princess Diana, Barry Manicky.
When I was 24, 25, I fell deeply in love with somebody who worked in this environment. And it was all found out, and he was chucked out, and then he was killed. And that was the biggest blow of my life, I must say. Which I don't find easy to discuss.
1985. Diana was now the mother of two young princes, and he was a royal protection officer, Barry Manicky.
I mean, I was quite happy to give all this up, not going to have all this. At the time, it was quite something to have all this, just to go off and live with everyone. Can you believe it?
Well, one can. It's
and he not... kept saying he thought it was a good idea too.
Oh, God,
no. I just needed to tell someone to tell me that I was all right. And he kicked me out, in the sense of mentally kick me outside and make me go into my engagements, because I used to sort of scream in this room. Charles thought he knew, but I never had any proof. I should never have paid a fine, and I did, and I got very burned. I was like a little girl in front of him the whole time. Desperate for praise. Desperate. And it got so difficult, and people got so jealous and bitchy in his house, and eventually he had to go. And 3 weeks after he left, he was killed in the motorbike accident. And he was the greatest friend I've ever had.
Well, killed in a motorbike accident 3 weeks after he left, but the greatest friend Diana ever had, she says. And it was interesting to see the Daily Mail actually printing a story, was the bodyguard Diana fell in love with bumped off? Sue Reid examining the evidence over her claims in tapes which were aired, that was in Saturday's Daily Mail. All sorts of interesting claims in there, Martin. Sensationally, the princess went on to say of his death, I think he was bumped off. A less reliable custodian of the princess's memories, James Hewitt, the army officer, who also became her lover, has added added to the conspiracy theories by saying he received anonymous death threats and was told to end their relationship. He claimed that MI5 visited him and warned that he could meet the same end as Barry Manicky. Crucially, Nicola Chop, the novice driver blamed for his death, told the Mail she suspects evidence was concocted by the police and that she was put under intense pressure to plead guilty in court to a charge of driving without due care and attention. Adding to the sense of intrigue, Nicola says an unidentified woman in glasses and driving an estate car was involved, but never traced. Also, Nicola has letters to her lawyer at the time from a young man called Richard Purnell, who witnessed the accident and kindly helped her out of her Ford Fiesta after the crash. He walked to her home 5 minutes away. Richard, too, said he saw the bespectacled female driver in the mystery estate. Yet not only has the woman never come forward, but Mr. Purnell, the vital Good Samaritan eyewitness, was surprisingly not summoned to give any evidence at the inquest. Later, Purnell became a British Airways flight attendant, but lost his long-term memory after a mugging incident in the Canary Islands. Mr. Purnell recovered, but a few years ago committed suicide. The verdict of accidental death came after the police investigators gave evidence blamed the crash on a glare of car lights. Now, it's a little bit suspicious, surely, that both Diana and her close personal friend died in these so-called car accidents.
Well, I mean, these kind of allegations or suspicions have been floating around for a very long time. And does the British state do things like this? I think the answer is probably yes. If you live in West Belfast, you'll remember Cathy McCarthy, who was shot dead. She was only 23. They thought that both her own side, Sinn Féin, and others thought that she was a future president of Ireland. She's not a future president of Ireland. Shot dead by the UDA. And, you know, the UDA, as we know, working through the Force Research Unit, was being directed by the British Army Intelligence, by Brigadier Gordon Kerr. But did they kill these people in these circumstances? It's a legitimate question, but we don't know the answer.
Some other suspicious deaths around Prince Charles. Around March 2009, Jude Richmond, a florist to royalty and others, and her disabled daughter were found drowned in Cotswold Water Park Lake near their home. That was supposedly suicide. September 2009, Sarah Champion Lowe, she was another florist to Prince Charles, was sacked weeks after her husband was found dead in an estuary, supposedly having again committed suicide. And September 2014, Jacintha Saldana, she was a nurse that took a hoax call in hospital where Kate Middleton was being treated for severe morning sickness. She too committed suicide. But at the end of the day, there have actually been calls today, apparently, for or at least some reporting that even the Queen thinks that perhaps royalty, that the royal family, should skip a generation and go to William and Kate and sort of miss Charles out, Harriet.
Yes, I don't know whether this is true. I did see a headline about it. Obviously, William and Kate are very popular, aren't they? And maybe it would... They might be seen as a breath of fresh air away from all this scandal. I must say, all the stuff you've just read out, it sounds like a John le Carré novel, doesn't it? Extraordinary. Yeah, I'm on the whole, I'm not a believer in conspiracy theories. I'm more of a cock-up believer. But it does seem to be that there's very high pressure on people in this setup. I remember the Jacinta case. That was a very sad story, wasn't it? Poor woman. She got terrible slandering, I think, and was overcome by it all. It was really sad. But yes, it seems that the Queen doesn't get on with Charles. He does seem to be a difficult character, although, of course, he gets on very well with celebrities like Stephen Fry. So there's obviously something in him that some people respond to. But I suppose I can see the rationale for starting off again with a generation that's so far free from scandal.
The final clip is where, again, voiced by an actress from the Panorama programme. And, of course, this programme was called Diana in her own words. So the idea, I think, was if Diana had still been alive, what would she be saying? What would she be thinking? Let's have her version of events rather than the royal families. And, of course, if you go to somewhere like Highgrove, just up the road here, where Prince Charles lives, Diana's been totally expunged from history. And there are some people out there, including myself, that are not really interested in that. So let's hear what was being said by the royal family and what Diana thought of the way she was treated after her bulimia, etc.
Friends,
on my husband's side were indicating that I was unstable, sick, and should be put in a home of some sort in order to get better. There's no better way to dismantle a personality than to isolate it.
Now, Martin, it's a terribly sad situation she's in there, because she is being asked to have a kind of public-facing relationship with Prince Charles when she knows that he doesn't love her. He loves someone else called Camilla, and yet she is being told that she is the one who's insane.
Well, yes, and all of these things, as you say, have been, you know, because of the anniversary, people are talking about all of these things. I'd just like to remember one thing about Princess Diana, which is a campaign about landmines, because I was working for the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development at the time, and she gave that real oomph. And I think if you're thinking of motives for her assassination, if indeed she was assassinated, you might find that it's more to do with her developing political consciousness than it is with the rows inside the family. Because that landmines campaign was very successful, and there's quite a lot of people out there who make landmines who are not happy at all about what she was doing.
Well, she managed to persuade Bill Clinton to get on board the programme,
didn't
she?
That's right, and that, of course, was really threatening to people who make landmines.
So, the reason for the apparent royal announcement, William and Kate will officially be king and queen, was on the Yahoo website yesterday, but it's now been removed. So I guess that might have been one of the news wires just having a bit of fun with us all.
Yes.
But I think that there's definitely a sentiment along those lines out there. So I'll put a link to that, because I imagine we'll be able to find the original Yahoo thing somewhere. There's people on the internet that try and make sure these stories survive even once they've been removed. Anyway, on to our next story now, and Newcastle sex ring. People care more about being called racist than preventing child abuse, says Rotherham's Labour MP. Speaking on the BBC's Radio 4 Today programme, Mrs Champion said there was a need to acknowledge that in all the towns with similar cases, the majority of perpetrators have been British Pakistanis. Now, this is up in Newcastle. More prosecutions this week child sex rings, even though they're not, I mean, it's difficult to whether you use the terminology child of a 15-year-old, 16-year-old, but this is not paedophilia, this is underage sex going on, but it's predominantly with the Pakistani community. But a lot of the reporting of it doesn't seem to want to talk about the racial angle.
Well, I think each case has to be judged exactly on its merits. If it is Pakistanis involved, the law should take its course. And of course, if it's not taking its course because some people are holding back and don't want the scandal, well, that's not acceptable. But I'm quite sure that it's not just Pakistanis who are involved in abuse of young people. It's sadly far more common than many people realise.
Well, what about the allegation that the police turned a blind eye to it because they didn't want to be accused of being racist?
Well, that's an allegation, and it needs to be looked at, doesn't it? If that is the case, then that's not acceptable. But we can't just presume it's the case, because that's the sort of thing that the tabloid Tory press want to talk about. It might be true, and it might not be true.
Although, of course, the other side of this is that if the police do turn a blind eye to crime when people come to them with evidence, that is potentially misconduct in public office.
Well, it is. And, of course, talking about difficult jobs, the police have a difficult job, don't they? And sometimes they don't do it too well. I mean, we've got senior police officers on trial over Hillsborough after all these years. And, of course, the point about the law is it's above everybody. And that includes the law on the succession to the monarchy, by the way. The reason why Prince Charles should be the king is because that's what the rules are, unless we change them.
Well, actually, but according to the rules, he wasn't supposed to marry Camilla, was he, according to the law?
Well, no, he could marry Camilla because he was divorced from...
Because the royal family has got to follow these very old traditions when it comes to marriage. Like, for example,
those are only conventions. They're not allowed to marry Catholics.
Well, no,
they're not allowed to marry Catholics.
Martin, let me just tell you, it is a law. Yeah, there is a law that's. I mean, this came out when Charles did marry Camilla. There is a legal statute that says that what the royal family are and aren't allowed to do. Anyway, Harriet, what do you make of this? What do you make of this? Well, you can poo-poo it if you want, Martin. If you want, I'll put up right, a link on our show page
let's just
specific
check the facts.
Law which says that you cannot marry a divorcee if you're in the royal family. Anyway, so back to the crucial issue here, actually, which is up in Newcastle, Harriet. People care more about being called racist and preventing child abuse. Is that true, do you think?
Well, I agree with Martin that this is an allegation. We really don't know that this is the case at all. Obviously, it's a worrying situation, and there is a suggestion that there is a view that because of the difference in sexual habits between the Pakistani community and the white community, young white women are seen as kind of sluts, if you like. But I think we need to be very careful about this. It's a very dangerous road to go down at the moment because of all the stuff around the fight against terrorism, which has led to a terrible outburst of Islamophobia, and frankly the number of people who are being targeted by that is just as great as the number of the young women who are suffering as a result of the behaviour of these particular people. And certainly it's not just Pakistanis who use young women as prostitutes. The punters come from all kinds of backgrounds. So I think we should be very careful about drawing these kind of conclusions.
I mean, apparently this has been going on for nearly a decade. What about the role of the police in turning a blind eye here? Because people have been reporting this in many of these cities and the police have simply not been acting.
Well, I don't know enough about this to argue that case. But what I do know is that there's been a lot of news recently about modern slavery, which isn't just sexual exploitation, but it is a lot about sexual exploitation, but also about children from other countries, immigrant children being forced to work for free, locked up in places and forced to do various things. So I think there's a whole difficult world out there which we don't really know how to tackle. And I suppose the police, I don't know. I can't really say. I think we'd need to look into this more carefully. I mean, people often report crimes and people try and look into them and can't get any evidence. The police can't do things unless they have hard evidence, and it may have been very difficult to get. So I wouldn't want to be judgmental. But I do think, as Martin has said, you know, if the police did ignore this and overlook it, then that was wrong and they should be brought to account.
Also, look, I mean, I suppose we should, in a way, go back to the real big news today. That's Jeremy Corbyn's appearance in Bristol, Harriet. What was going on today? He was in Filton, I think, wasn't he?
Yes, he's doing a tour at the moment of all the marginal seats, which the Labour Party believes it could win if there's another general election soon, which, of course, as a Labour supporter, I hope there will be. So Jeremy's been away on holiday, as you probably have heard recently, with his wife in Croatia. He's just come back. He was down in Cornwall at the weekend, and he came to the British Airways Workers Association to talk to Labour supporters. I think it was a bit sad that he was speaking to a Labour Party members only gathering, which was by ticket, and the ticket sold out very quickly because people are very intrigued to see Jeremy, of course. But I would have liked to have seen it maybe held on the sports field up there so that local residents could come along and hear what he has to say.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're obviously there, the people who will be voting for him.
Exactly.
It sounds like he's shooting himself in the foot there.
I don't think it's him.
I think he actually
likes going to these big things.
He was surrounded by people who aren't necessarily working in his best interest.
Well,
anyway,
that's true,
Jack Lepresti, who's the MP up there, he's been in the news the last couple of days,
yes,
saying that Britain will join the United States if war is declared with North Korea, Martin.
Well, I think that's rather unwise of Jack, if you don't mind me saying so.
We will stand by our US ally, he says.
Yes, well, I mean, as we know, Lepresti is very in with the BAE Systems Management, and he's been out to Saudi Arabia several times touting their wares. When are we declaring war on Saudi Arabia, by the way? I'm sure we are, because they're a dictatorship, aren't they? They've invaded Yemen. Something's got to be done. But aren't we declaring war, Tony?
Not as far as I know.
Oh, we're not declaring war on Saudi Arabia. We're declaring war on North Korea. I'd say Saudi Arabia is a bit closer to us than North Korea, though, isn't it? Surely we should be more worried about
Saudi. Yes, but I'm afraid we've got lots of arms deals. $3 billion a year's worth with Saudi Arabia.
Oh, dear.
We're not selling a lot of arms, apart from... Do you want to tell us about your theory about where these North Korean nuclear weapons
came
from?
Well, it's a long story, but I have a
just have the short version.
I have a contact who was involved in selling weapons to South Africa before the apartheid regime came down. And because of these contacts, he's told me that the source of the nuclear material that the North Koreans are using is actually originally South African nuclear weapons, which were supposedly dismantled at the end of apartheid, but through various mechanisms in which senior British people were involved, including Tory ministers. They ended up on the black market and in the hands of North Koreans.
Well, the point here being, I suppose, that the people who had these weapons, the AWB and the rest of them, didn't really want black majority rule leaders like Nelson Mandela and Jacob Zuma to get their hands on them.
Well, there were originally 10 warheads, which were uranium-based warheads, which had been developed with the help of the Israelis at Pearl Harbor. One of those was exploded over the South Atlantic. That left 9 warheads. And as the changes were taking place in South Africa, Magnus Malan, who was the defence minister, approached the West and said, well, you don't want Nelson Mandela to have these weapons, we don't want him to have them, will you take them off our hands, but you'll have to pay us. And 6 of them were bought by the Americans and shipped to Dayton, Ohio, and dismantled. 3 were bought by a private company called Astra Holdings, which is headed by a guy called
is it Kenneth Warren?
Stephen Cock.
Oh, no, sorry.
Stephen Cock.
Is Kenneth Warren involved as well?
Kenneth Warren used to be the main Tory party fundraiser. Yes, he was involved in this deal. They basically bought these weapons from the South African Defence Ministry for $30,000, and they sold them on to the British for $50,000. $50 million. Sorry,
that's not a lot of money for
no. I've got confused there.
That's a snip.
No, we're talking about millions of pounds here, and in actual fact, that the Tory Party itself received £17 million for the 1992 election.
The reason I'm asking,
the final point is that these weapons then went missing because they were dealing with a guy called John Bradenkamp, who's based in Kilmers down here, and Billy Reutenbach, who are both Rhodesian ex-SAS, and they basically double-crossed the consortium, the Astra Holdings consortium, and they didn't in fact supply the...
So how did they get the money?
Who got the money?
The Conservatives.
Well, what happened was that the consortium that bought the weapons via Astra Holdings bought the weapons from the South Africans and then sold them on to the British government, and Margaret Thatcher signed one of the last things she signed was say, well, it's $50 million for this stuff, which didn't specify what it was, but the stuff was never delivered. And of course,
Got the money, but they never.
Yeah, the 3 warheads were never delivered, and of course, Bradenkamp, who they were dealing with, was then said, well, we've paid you the money for these warheads. Where are they? And said, there are no warheads. What are you talking about? Are you going to call the cops?
Well, I think at this point, I ought to say that this is just rumour. In places like Kilmers down in Somerset, this is the sort of thing they talk about down the pubs. But the implication here is that there's actually quite an important letter which Jacob Rees-Mogg has. And this is the reason I bring this up, is because we're hearing this week that the Tories are backing none of the above in a survey over which cabinet minister should succeed Theresa May. One minister told The Independent this week that the survey shows it's time to look beyond the cabinet for the next leader. Another indication it could be Jacob.
Well, Jacob Rees-Mogg clearly wants to be leader of the Tory party and prime minister. I don't think there's any doubt about that. He's been very ambitious. But his family are implicated in this scandal, of which I've got one good source for this information.
But what about this letter that Jacob Rees-Mogg has?
The letter is actually a letter, according to my source, it's a letter from Tony Blair to the Labour MP for Radstock, who was called Dan Norris, because Dan Norris was the war whip in the run-up to the 2003 war in Iraq. And he said to Tony Blair, I've got to, because he'd been approached by locals in the area saying that the warheads that were missing were potentially these ones that are South African warheads. And Tony Blair then wrote him a letter saying no, he could categorically say that it wasn't the case. And that letter has come into the hands of Rees-Mogg, and he's using that, according to my source, in order to blackmail other members of
okay,
the Tory party.
All a vicious rumour, but certainly would be a handy sort of thing to have, to, if you could use it to sort of lever your way into power, something like that. Anyway, I'm not going to ask you to comment on that, Harriet, because this is really just a vicious rumour.
Well, it does really sound like a John Le Carré novel. Well, so I mean, this one.
Truth is actually stranger than fiction.
It is extraordinary, yeah.
Don't forget, the linkage between the South Africans and the right wing of the Tory party and the Rhodesian SAS is very intimate.
Yes.
Okay. Mm. Also, I know you wanted to have a word about library closures in the city, Harriet.
Yes, oh dear, this is a terrible thing that's happening at the moment, of course. as you know, the council has to balance a budget as a result of some actual mishandling of previous budget by the previous regime, plus the cuts of imposed by Tory legislation.
Well, some would say creative accounting that stopped the cuts happening, and we could do with a bit of that now.
I only wish it could be done. I think they are trying very hard, and of course they're doing this consultation which Councillor Asher Craig has been in charge of, so we are all having our say. But what I can say is that the citizens of Bristol are very, very fond of their libraries. My constituents in Brislington West and Brislington East too, because our library, Wick Road Library, sits on the boundaries of the two wards. We held a meeting the other day, and this is in the school holidays when a lot of people are away, and 95 people turned up to meet with Councillor Craig. And they were all saying, she was saying, what do you want? They were saying, we want our library and we want it to continue to be funded by the council, because that's the only way we feel the future of the library will be secure. And I do feel very strongly that cutting the libraries is a step too far. Bristol calls itself a learning city, and what is a library if it's not a source of learning?
Well, one of the
it's
things-
also a source of succour to vulnerable people. People can go there to sign on, to use the computer to sort out their benefits.
Well, again, it's about money, like not people. And looking at the costs of Metrobus, apparently it's rising another £10 million to £230 million before it opens, and it's going to make almost no difference whatever to congestion.
It is a very worrying thing. Of course, one can hardly blame the current regime for that, because this was one of Ferguson's follies, if you like. I have to say, I know you may challenge me on this, because a lot of people quite like
Mark Bradshaw, he's the Labour guy.
I'm not sure that the arena is something that we can really afford at the moment, and that's vastly expensive as well. And of course, it hasn't even started the construction.
Back in the old days, we used to pay council tax, and central government would pay a grant for us to look after people who were vulnerable and poor. Now it seems this is totally the opposite. We're looking after big, rich companies that are having various sorts of problems.
It's deplorable, I'm afraid. It really is deplorable. It makes me very sad. And I've had many cases where...
So we're going to have to cut you off there. It's time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks for this. Labour Councillor for Brislington West, Harriet Bradley. See you after the news.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.